you just tell me something about your parents and your childhood, which seemed somewhat bizarre?
I can't tell you much about my parents because, of course, with small exceptions, I was not brought up by them. My father's family had been in the gem trade in India and Burma for a very great number of generations, approximately 200 years. I was born in the States, was taken away by his relatives, and raised in the gem trading family there.
What age did you leave your parents?
3 months. I made one visit to the States in between when I was something of that age, 7, I think, or 6. And aside from that, I didn't get back to them until I was just short of 18, a month before I was 18.
You must have been delighted to see your parents.
No, not particularly. In retrospect, at any rate, there was nothing to be delighted about. But people always say to me, if I tell them, you must have felt deprived and sad at being abandoned. I had a wonderful time as a child. I look back on it with great pleasure. I missed nothing.
Did you have an ayah?
We had various servants. We started out in a big house just outside of Calcutta. You know where Garden Reach is?
Garden Reach,
outside of Cal. All right, and we had a big house. And loads of relatives coming and going and staying and not staying. And it was very good for children because nobody knew who was in charge of anyone. So we were in a position to get into all kinds of trouble and blame it on someone else. It was very pleasant. But then, of course, off to Burma and a much smaller place. 24, in February of 1924, which makes me very shortly 80 years old. Now, you yourself are what?
61,
a mere child.
So you came back at 18, just briefly to see your parents, and then you went back to Burma, or?
No, I did not get back. I remember I got back at the beginning of 41, stayed, and then when I would have gone back, America had got into the war, because just before the end of that year, 45, in Pearl Harbor and all, and I didn't get back to Burma until we went back to do field work, my wife and I, in the beginning of 57. So it was a long gap before we got back. And you know, it was, I suppose the word is interesting, in that entire time, I never heard a word of Burmese. I never had any occasion to speak a word of it. And I forgot a lot of it by then. Well, it's come back. I studied it some, and it all was there in my head, and it came back. But it was, a long period of being away.
16 years. What did you do during that?
What did I do? What I did was prove how stupid I was. I had no particular skills that were marketable because, of course, I'd been apprenticed in the gem trade in Burma, not far from Yunnan, over in Lashio. You know where that is? Yeah, well, I know you know where it is, in northern Shan State. It's about 3 hours by a good car from the border, from Nankin. And so, as I say, I had no particular skills. We weren't yet, the states weren't yet in the war, and so you might think that that was irrelevant, but they were very involved in shipping over the Atlantic. So since I had nothing better to do and needed a job, I went down to the shipping offices in New York, and I knew they were looking for people, but I didn't know what I could do. And the hiring boss, as it's called there, asked me a question. He knew I spoke with an accent. I wasn't speaking like this. I was speaking that way in Indian English and so on. And he said, oh, you must be from far. I told him where I had grown up. And he said, oh, very hot over there, isn't it? Well, you can see what's coming. I said, yes, yes. Oh, it must be hard for you to really work in the heat. Oh, no, the hotter it is, the better. I like it. So I shoveled coal in the belly of a ship through much of the Second World War. I fell into the trap, you see. That's what I did. There was it led to one, I suppose, useful result. I resolved at the end of the war that I would never do an honest day's work again and decided to get an education. And I got one. I managed to take what is called in America a high school equivalency diploma, which allowed me to apply to university, and which is what I did. And I took my first degree, my bachelor's degree in mathematics and theoretical physics and things of that kind, and I enjoyed it. Once I had done that, I thought to myself that it would be a very wonderful idea if I could have some sort of academic profession that allowed me to come back to this part of the world, because I missed it. And besides, I'd become curious about it too, the things I'd seen, the things I'd grown up in the midst of. I had, at the same time as I was doing my undergraduate work at the university, there was another school. There was a rather good school at that time. It's defunct, Asian Institute. And Heiner Gelden was a professor there. And I started working with him. And I asked him at one point, I said, Professor Heiner, is there some sort of academic profession that, I didn't even know the name anthropology or ethnology or whatever, and he told me, yes, there was, and that's what it's called. He said, Germany, we call it ethnology, and in, well, Austria, actually, in his case, and in America, it's called anthropology, and it, you know. So I shifted my speciality from mathematics to anthropology and linguistics, and went on to Columbia University and took my PhD there.
Who were your teachers at Columbia?
Remember them? Yes, I remember them, but in a sense, well, they were my teachers, but there was no person I really could work under, because my interests in India and Southeast Asia were not supported by anyone who was then on the faculty. So, I mean, I worked on the theoretical side. I had people like Julian Steward, though he was not my supervisor. Because I was an Asianist of sorts, they had a very good China specialist there, a man named Morton Freed. You may not, you have heard. Well, he was my supervisor, but basically I did it all for myself because there was no one who was a specialist. Well, it was more complicated than that because, and this is something I'd said to you earlier, because I was unable to keep myself from trying to look at ethnographical materials in a formal mathematical way. There was no mathematical anthropology then, which I'm in now. But I couldn't help looking at things that way, and there was no one on the faculty, for the matter of that, there was no one on any anthropological faculty either in America or anywhere else that would have been any help. So I had to do that for myself too. But I had very good teachers, Stewart and Margaret Mead, with whom I became rather friendly in later years.
Can you, as we light on people, so to speak, in your history, it might be nice if you can just give either a pin picture or just a few words about them. I mean, not many people now have encountered Margaret Mead. So
Margaret was... I took a lot of lectures with her. She was only an adjunct professor. But I took evening lectures with her on various matters, and I don't know, I think she thought I was funny, and so she became friendly with me. She was on my doctoral committee and my oral exam and my thesis defense eventually, and for some reason totally unknown to me, she decided in later years that we'd become very close friends. And I remember 6 months before she died, we were at an American Anthropological Association meeting somewhere, Philadelphia, I think it was. And the end of a session we were in together, she says, "Chris, you have to come up to my room. There's something I have to tell you." I go up there and she says, "Look, I'm not telling a lot of people, I don't want people to know," but she says, "I've got maybe half a year left." That was my first and last intimation that she thought of me as a personal friend. I had no idea, but she could, you know, "I'm going to kick the bucket any moment, but don't tell anyone." I didn't tell anyone. No, she was a very strange woman with an extremely bad temper. I don't know if you'd ever heard that. She would...
She fell out with husbands.
If somebody... Huh?
I knew she fell out with various husbands, or husbands fell out with her, or something.
Oh, there are all kinds of stories about that. But at any rate, she could... If she felt that she had been offended or not properly respected, and that meant a great deal to her, she would get into public screaming rages. Oh, yes. You know, you talk of her various husbands. I don't know all the stories, but you know, to the last moment of her life, she was still deeply in love with Gregory Bateson. And she would talk of him and about him for hours. And she did that night when she told me, she said, "You know, Gregory isn't very well, and he's probably going to be dying soon," which he did, though long after her. And she said, "You know, now everything has to be to help Gregory and my daughter, our daughter's out there helping him. I don't, you know." It was a strange situation.
Did you feel that she would be a good anthropologist? In other words, was she interested in you or other people, or...
Oh, she was very interested. I understand what you mean. It's related to things we said at table a couple of weeks ago about Edmund, where we wondered how he ever could deal with people as an ethnographer, for he didn't with other people. And no, she was very interested in people. She had a natural curiosity about everybody she met and talked to. And I think that stood her in very good stead as an ethnographer. I don't want to get into the Margaret Mead, Derek Freeman mess. Let me say something about it. You know, it's inescapable if you get me talking about Margaret. It's inescapable to get into that. I think that Freeman, whom I never met, I'm happy to say, made a not uncommon error of assuming that because she had on occasion, with regard to her Samoan materials, made some errors, that therefore she was a bad worker. We all make errors, and eventually they're corrected either by ourselves or by someone who comes after us. She made some errors. She went out in the 1920s as an upper-class American young lady, and of course that required her in those days to be something of a captive of missionaries or whatever. Yeah, it was missionaries she lived with in Samoa. It's not the way we would do work today, but it wasn't today. And I think that's the long and the short of it. Now, the strange thing is, you know, that began whilst Margaret was still alive. And she took it very kindly. She said, oh, well, you know, so forth and so on. And they had first met when Derek was doing his work in the Iban, in that area. So they'd known each other for a great deal of time, you know. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I do know this, which I'm sure you know also. Do I address you as Alan?
Yes,
as
Alan.
Thank you. Which I think you know also, and that there was one point in that early history in which he was involved with something that was going wrong with her then current marriage and so on.
With
so,
Rio.
Huh?
Probably with Rio, was it?
With Rio. With Rio Fortune, your former colleague.
Yeah.
Another man who was stark staring bonkers.
That's right. Retired. I've never quite discovered whether he was stark staring bonkers or whether he made it up so that he would get early retirement and live a good life, but I think he probably was from the accounts of his students.
I had the distinct impression from my one encounter with him when I went to see Edmund Leach in Cambridge, and somebody, I believe it was Edmund, tried to take me down the hall. You people were still in the museum in those days in Downing, and take me to the, you know, here, you know, famous man. He's sitting in his room there, apparently never turned on the light. That was one of his things, as you recall. And Edmund tried to introduce me to him, and the man didn't even look up, and it was as if he didn't know anyone was speaking to him. I think that means stark staring bonkers. But at any rate, that's about it. Now, one of my professors at Columbia, as I said, was Julian Steward, and when I finished my preliminary examinations that admitted me to candidacy for the PhD, and I was starting to do the research for my dissertation, he had been invited to start a large anthropology program in the Midwest at the University of Illinois, and he met me in the hallway at Columbia at one point and said, oh, Lehman, you wouldn't happen to need a job, would you? I mean, this was equivalent to asking me if I wished to eat regularly, because in those days, things, you know, it was in the early 50s, things weren't so good financially, not in academic life. And of course I said yes. So he brought me out to the University of Illinois I got there in September of 52, which is a long while ago. He was very supportive of my work for a number of years, but since you're asking for little sketches that give you a picture of people, in the earliest part of the late 50s and early 60s, I began quite seriously extending, excuse me please, my mathematical background to anthropological materials, and also I got back into formal linguistics for the obvious reason that Chomsky's syntactic structures had just come out, and that obviously fitted the way I think about these things. So I started to do a lot of linguistics and a lot of this mathematical stuff. He was infuriated. He said, I've never done any of these things, I'm not good at either of them, and don't really know anything about them, and I don't see why you're doing it. You're supposed to be my research associate, and so forth and so on. Fortunately, it was a new department. We had a first head of department, and it wasn't Stewart, who said, look, I'll get you out of this, a man called Joseph Casagrande, whom you wouldn't know of, I think. And he says, I'll get you a regular teaching appointment, tenure track appointment, which he did. And from that day till Stewart's death, I doubt we said a civil word to one another ever again. I mean, he was a man of exceedingly narrow intellectual vision. He had a lot of depth and no breadth, and, that was, excuse me?
I obviously have read quite a bit of this stuff, and it does seem quite narrow.
It is. Interesting as far as it goes, but you know, in some respects, and some of his best pupils, people like Eric Wolff and Sidney Mintz, both names that you're acquainted with, both were in the habit of saying that Julian was largely illiterate. He didn't read much, and the consequences, he had to reinvent some kind of Marxist theory all for himself, because he really didn't know anything about it. And that's really what he did, you know. This used to bother his great rival, Leslie White at Michigan. But I won't go into those details either. They're all on this big set of lectures that are being recorded.
So you went on, and while you were teaching, you were doing a PhD, or had you already done it?
No, I had finished my examinations. I was taken out, brought out to Illinois as a research associate in Stewart's new program out there. And I did teach one or two things in the spring term of 53. Whilst I was doing my dissertation, that was not field work, it was a complicated library thing concerning India, and it was applying a lot of Stewart's ideas in my own fashion. It's a good piece, far too long. But
what was your PhD on?
It was on India, it was on the cultural history of India. And it, as I said, it was a far too ambitious, far too long piece of work. It was absurd to do something like that, but I did it anyhow. It worked out, it was a good piece. And so I did a lot of the preliminary work on that I was there for a year and a half, 18 months. And I got a grant of money to do a postdoctoral course in Indology and linguistics, South Asian linguistics, at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. So I went off to that, in the course of which I more or less finished writing my dissertation. But I didn't get my degree then, and the reason looks odd from the standpoint of the way things are today, but you see, it was a very long dissertation, and 800 pages there, about something of that kind, typewritten. And it had to be typed by a professional typist, and you know, with carbon copies and so on.
As was mine. Yes.
I'm sure yours was, and I couldn't afford it. I had no money to get it typed, so I had to put off taking my degree. Meanwhile, I got another grant of money to go off to Burma because I wanted to go to the Chin area on the western mountains next to India and do some things there, partly triggered by Leach's work, which was out after all in 54, but the more importantly, the technical papers had been out before that, largely in the JRAI, as you recall, the ones on Alliance and so on, yeah. The ones reprinted in Rethinking. I was able to do that. Went out in, we got there in the beginning of 57, in February of 57, and were there through much of 58. When I got back to America in later part of 58, I had saved enough money to get my thesis typed, at which point I took my degree. So I didn't take my degree until early 59, even though I'd finished my classwork and examinations in the spring of 52. But in those days, there weren't many grants. There weren't academic jobs, and what there was didn't pay enough. And the consequence is I didn't take my degree till 59. From now, that's still a long time ago, but there was a big gap. But I had no difficulty with it, except, as I've told you, the thesis was concerned with India, with South Asia, and they had to import a South Asianist from Pennsylvania to be my external examiner because there was nobody at Columbia that knew anything about that either. But there was no difficulty with it at all. So I did finally take my degree, at which point I was invited back to Illinois. I hadn't quite broken with Stewart then, as I say, but about a year and a half later, I had broken with him, but then things were all right for me. And I've been there ever since. This is now 51 years, is that right? Starting in 52, and this is 03, that makes it 51 years, more or less in the same institution. Long time.
Long time, under the new American policy of no forced retirement.
Well, yes, it's federal law. They are not allowed to force people to retire simply on the grounds of age. And this has both advantages and disadvantages, because I need not tell you that for many academic people, once they've been sitting in their academic chairs for many years, they cease to do any new work. They have nothing new to say. They're no longer contributing to the scholarship of their respective fields. They are, in short, dead wood, and you can't get rid of them. And this means that younger people coming up who can and should be contributing don't have a position or find it hard to get one. So I don't think it's entirely good, but in my case, at any rate, I am continuing to do new work. I'm here having just about completed 10 months of field work and writing other things and getting it published, or you know, whilst I'm here. And so I don't really think that I should have retired because I'm still working, but there are a lot of people who should have been forced, you know, sent to the knackers, basically, long since.
That seems an appropriate moment just to turn to your current work. It would be very nice if you could just give up.
All right, what I've been doing this year, got here on the last day of January. I shall be leaving, this being the 29th of October, I shall be leaving here to go back to the States on the 21st of next month, 21st of November. What I have been doing here is something I had wanted to do for many, many years. You have to remember something about my background, and I've told it you in the, I've told it to your machine. Your camera. And it's that I grew up in my later years, largely in Burma, in the gem trade round the China border, dealing with Burmans, Shan, Thai, other upland groups on both sides of the border, and in India too. And it had always fascinated me. And I had been apprenticed in the jade and gemstones trade, so I knew at least something about it. And it seemed to me I would like to do some ethnography on the, if I may use the silly jargon that's current and that I have used, multi-ethnic cross-border trade. A number of things. As I said, there is my background, but in addition, because I do know something about jade and gemstones and the actual trade, I thought that I might be able to do something that for once counts as honest-to-goodness participant observation. There's a great deal of nonsense, as all anthropologists know, about this expression, participant observation, which for many ethnographers seems to mean, well, we learn how to do some of the native dances, or we pretend to have been adopted by a household or something. Of course, that's not what it ought to mean. It ought to mean having or making for yourself a place within that community, a role or whatever, and participating in that sense. But at any rate, I figured that I was in position to do participant observation because I could participate in that part of the trade that was the gem trade. And when I was here in the summer, when my wife and I should say, were here in the summer of 2 years ago, 2001, was doing some brief ethnographic work with a graduate student among the Wa southeast of here in southeastern Yunnan. And I was asked by one of the institutes here, the Center for Border Studies and Ethnic Minorities in southwestern China, Professor Fang Jie is the director, I know you know him. He asked me if I'd like to do something of the sort. Well, of course, I said I'll have to think about it, and the answer is yes. It didn't take me long. It was partly a put-up job because my former pupil, Professor Yang Hui here, had sort of told him about my background. I don't think she knew. Well, yes, she did know, because the study had been planned with her late husband, but then he died, so I didn't do it again. But at any rate, I was asked to come back and do it. So here I am. And we worked largely in the place called Zhili, formerly known by its proper Thai name as Meng Mao, right on the border across from Muse in the northern Shan State. Well, Muse over here and Nankang over there. And we worked for off and on, the total is a bit over 5 months in Zhi Li. We also worked in Tangshung, and we had a month studying it on the other side in Burma in August and September. It was, 24 days, we can call it a month if you want. It's been quite productive, and I think like any decent empirical research, be it ethnography or the sort of thing I started life out in a laboratory, it's led to some unanticipated results and taken to some extent directions that had not been anticipated to begin with, but decent research should do that. It should take advantage of what one really sees and what one really encounters and gets into, and if it's interesting, you follow it up. I have no patience with people who say, again, it doesn't make any difference if we're talking about a lab science or if we're talking about ethnography, no difference at all. I have a great deal of impatience with people who say, but that wasn't part of your original plan. No, it wasn't, because in decent research, you don't really know what you're going to find. But at any rate, here it's been. My assistant and pupil, Walter here, Yuan, yes, show him. He's sitting here because he's interested, among other things, in finding how you do the interviewing. There you are. There he is. And my wife, Domya Dwe, is there, and she has worked with me in every single field expedition from 1957 until this year as a very active ethnographic technician. And at any rate, in the case of Ewan Walter, if you want by his English, call him by his English name, because of his background and skills and training, not only in anthropology, but also his earlier training in sinology, I was able to get deeply involved in something on which there is virtually no material until what we've been able to put together, namely the ethnography of the Chinese community in Burma. This is a strange matter. There is a huge literature, some of it very good, but at any rate a great deal of it, on the Chinese in Southeast Asia, immense amounts of material for Indonesia, Malaysia, of course, Singapore, a great deal for Thailand, obviously a lot with regard to Vietnam, with nothing for Burma. Well, it turns out that what we've discovered, again, with a great deal of thanks to Yuan, what we were able to find is that all the stuff written about the Chinese in Southeast Asia, well, Burma doesn't quite work the same way. One of the things that we were able to really come to grips with is the distinction, I mean ethnographically, not just historically, the distinction between the overland and the overseas Chinese communities. They're not without important interconnections, but their mode of social and cultural adaptation in Burmese society, their modes are quite different and very interesting, and there's no real parallel to this in the Chinese and Southeast Asia literature from all these other countries. Well, obviously I didn't plan to do this, but We didn't tell people, oh, shut up, that's not, we didn't tell our informants, oh, shut up, that's not what we're here to study. They gave us this material, it was valuable, and we've made use of it. Now, I should say, in, what shall I say, extenuation of our having to some extent gone in this direction, that our, that it wasn't unrelated to the main thrust of the project as originally planned, because they're only there in Burma because of the, well, gem and other trade. I mean, my own speciality was the gem trade, and that's how we got into it. But it's a natural extension of what I had originally planned. At any rate, this is what I've been doing. I am now putting together my report for the center here, which I want to give them before I leave, and then there's going to be a great deal of writing to be done, some of it with Yuen, the part on the Chinese in Burma with him, and a lot of the other stuff on the gem trade and other trades proper in the border that I'll be doing. It turns out, if you want me to say a few words more, I'd like to. All right. A great deal of what made me want to come here, and a great deal of what I have, in fact, I hope effectually done, has to do with a problem in cognitive anthropology. That is noisy. Oh, I see what it is. Everybody's yelling at everyone else. Well, it's a problem in cognitive theory and cognitive anthropology, which is one of the things I'm into, and I'll describe it informally, and it has proven very interesting. Here you've got a number of different sociocultural communities. I hate that jargon. Burmans, two kinds of Chinese, to some extent Jingpo, Kachin, Dai, Shan, certainly, involved in a complicated trading network. Let's stick with just the gem trade itself, where I have richer data, of course. And they're all involved in it, and they all interact, and no two of those communities have the same knowledge and the same understanding of what they are involved in. And the question that I was concerned with, technically it goes by the name of the problem of differentially distributed knowledge, is how this settles down into a working system. It is quite incredible that no two of these communities see this trade the same way, have the same kind of knowledge, understanding, assumptions about it, and so on, and yet it settles down into an orderly, integrated system. And the modeling of this thing, which will involve some fairly formal computational work, the modeling of this is going to prove challenging, but I think interesting. I've done some beginnings on it here already. You see, all the other important work on this problem of differentially distributed knowledge has been done in the context of systems in which there's a central authority who has an overview. There isn't one here, so it's a very challenging problem for me and for people who are into this sort of thing, and there are others, many, and that's what I'm very much involved in. Of course, I am incapable of not doing some linguistic work too, and I've been able, with a colleague of mine in the States, a linguist friend, colleague, I've been able to get involved in two quite ancillary linguistic bits of work, one well, we're doing, he and I are doing a book on the Shan, on the Thai, and on their various, linguistically, the relation among the dialects and the differences and how you describe them and so on. It's largely phonological work, phonetic work, and I've been able to add a good deal to that. And by accident, because of the work we did in Tung Chung, and the related area, and it was a dialect I was familiar with as a child, that dialect of Chinese, Southwestern Yunnanese. There's some work on that that bears on the whole history of the phonology of Mandarin Chinese, and he and I are working on that too. So I've got a lot done, and I'm not unhappy to be going back. I'd rather be going back to Mandalay, but it's nice to go back and see our grandchildren. You have any grandchildren?
We have. I will tell you about them afterwards.
Okay.
I'm sure you've got pictures too. Okay, now I was going to just ask you about briefly, it was about your experience of China. How often you've been, what are the main changes you see in your feelings about it?
All right. Now, you must understand that my knowledge of China is in all respects limited to just this part of China. I have visited Beijing twice. I have spent a few days over the years here and there in Guangzhou, in Canton. Other than that, I do not know China except Yunnan. I haven't even been to Dali and Lijiang, where you've been up there doing such fascinating work. But my first time to cross into Yunnan was in 1938. And my first time in Kunming here, which in those days nobody really called Kunming, they called it Yunnanfu, Yunnanese provincial capital, was in early 39. And I assure you the changes are considerable. I will tell you what I remark again and again to everyone, simply because it sticks in my mind, that's all. I repeat myself all the time, but then that's what sticks in my head. When I first came to Kunming, a place where now there are all these very modern high-rise buildings going up all the time and already in existence. In those days, there was one tall structure. Do you know the bell tower over here in Yunda? That was it. You could see it everywhere. It was the only building above two or maybe a few three-story buildings. There were no paved roads. I have no exact figures, but you know, I doubt it was a million population, if that. Now it's 5 million. It was a remote, marginal provincial capital. It is now an extremely modern, cosmopolitan city. That changes very much so. My reaction to it is that I guess I feel comfortable here because I've known it directly or indirectly for so long. I haven't found myself this year or 2 years ago in a place that feels totally alien to me. If you've grown up in this cross-border trade in northern Burma, China's never far away. I don't mean only that it isn't far away geographically. It isn't far away conceptually, if I may say it that way. I wish that I had been able to really control the language. As it is, I understand a reasonable amount of Chinese and don't speak it, and this is an infernal nuisance. And I apologize for it. No, I really do. It's not the right way to go. On the other hand, when I was working down in Sri Lanka and so on, of course there's a lot of Burmese and Shan, and those languages I know, so I wasn't isolated in terms of language, and had very good person to work with and so on. No, it wasn't an ideal situation from that, but on the other hand, when one is working on a, again to use the same silly jargon, on a multi-ethnic project, it's extremely unlikely that a single investigator is going to be able to control all of the languages involved anyhow. It's true that I'm working within China, but on the other hand, I wasn't working in a research context that was in any great degree Chinese exclusively. So again, I'm apologizing and excusing myself for something I should have done better. But it's been productive, I think successful, and so I shall go back not dissatisfied. I hope the people that brought me here to do this feel the same way.
You came to Yunnan very early, but how frequent have your visits?
All right. I came to really with my family in the gem trade a couple of times, well, to Meng Mao as it was then. Nobody ever bothered to call it really. What was it, 32 or 33 that it became officially really?
32.
32, right, that's what I thought. It was officially renamed really, but nobody ever called it that until the 1950s. So I came there across the border, as I say, it's no great distance. Then we came all the way up here to Kunming once in early 39, and that was all. The next time I ever set foot in China, other than Hong Kong, when then which was still British then anyhow, the only other time I don't get close to that, I have to get close to myself, the mic's here, was the next time I got to China was in the late 70s, the latter part of the 1970s, I forget the exact year. There was a big Sino-Tibetan linguistics conference held largely in Beijing, but part of it, the latter part of it, came here. And then I got back here briefly for a handful of days in whatever it was, the late 70s, since I'm very much involved in the Sino-Tibetan conference. I'm one of the founders. It's held every year since the end of the 60s, since 69, and sometimes in Asia, and so I came here then. Then I didn't get back here until 2 years, no, until, when was the next time I came here? 1997, I was here because my former pupil, the founder of anthropology department here at Yunda, the late Wang Chusheng, the late husband of Professor Yang Hui, had organized a big international conference on anthropology and this area of the world, so he invited me, so I came. At the end of that conference, he and I and a few other people, friends of his, of mine, went down to Sri Lanka and so on, partly because I wanted to get back there and see, and I discovered at that time that really had become, for reasons I shall not go into here, had become a major cross-border gem trading center. It had not been previously. Has to do with essentially it having become a free port, or Chicago having become a free port in the 90s. And So I got very fascinated and met some of the people in the gem trade who, it turned out, had some connection with our bunch back in Nashio before the Japanese War, which you call the Second World War, maybe. And, well, we don't here in English. We always refer to it as the Japanese, or at least in Burma. I got very fascinated and made some nice contacts there. And Professor Wang Tusheng and I planned to do what I've actually undertaken this year. Alas, he died of liver cancer a year and a half later, and we never did it. So then, as I say, I came back again 2 years ago just for a summer's work on a technical project among the Hua, and was invited to do this. So it's not many times. A couple of cross-border times in 38, once in 39, briefly in the late 70s, 97 for a conference, and 2 years ago, 01. Now, this year, it's six times. Not much.
You commented on the huge economic things of it.
On the what?
Huge architectural and economic change of Kunming. What about the political change in the atmosphere in China since over the last 10 years or so, which you've known?
I can say something about that because it is off. Oops, there's your. Is this still working? It fell down.
Yes, it's
all right. Sorry about that, I didn't know it would. In impressionistic terms, certainly, great deal of change. You know, in the late 70s, when I came for that Sino-Tibetan conference, China was just beginning to, as they say, open up, whatever that means. 2 years before, when the conference had been held in Paris, that was the first time any of our colleagues from China ever were able to go and attend that conference, with the consequence of which we were invited here 2 years later. So the time I was here was either 76 or 77, because I know that the Paris one was 74. And, of course, as I said, the first part of it was in Beijing, then it was here, and the atmosphere was one in which you were being watched carefully at all times. That was far truer in Beijing than it was here. I remember there was one of us, he's now gone, he was Chinese, but he had been in the United States for many years. He was a Catholic priest, a linguist at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., Paul Yang. And he was originally from Beijing, and he had relatives. But he had to violate the law to go and visit them in their flat in Beijing, and because he wasn't allowed to without getting permission. Of course, nowadays, you know, you still see on the hotels here, some of them licensed to accept tourists and foreigners. But of course, that's no longer actually part of the law. The place you can stay depends on whom you can get to take you in, basically now. Now, it wasn't that. Wasn't even like that in 97. You had to be very careful where you were staying and so on, and whom you talked to and that sort of thing. And in terms of the physical setup in 97, I first came here again, and certainly in the 70s, no, particularly in the 70s, when late 70s when I first was here, Kunming was only beginning to build. You know, they sometimes refer to Kunming in English as the city of perpetual spring. This is pretty rotten spring weather we're having. But in any case, I always think of it these days as the city of perpetual construction. But it's much more then than now. Well, I will explain to you. In the 70s and even in 97, all the trees on the streets were dying. There was so much construction dust that the leaves got all coated in the, it was really quite serious. This is all, a lot of this stuff's replanted, because hundreds and hundreds of trees along many of the streets died because the leaves were coated with construction dust. This seems an odd situation, but I assure you that was it. In those times, certainly in the 70s when we were walking around, there were a lot of the old buildings placed. There were neighborhoods within a 10-minute walk from where we're sitting now, down along the railway tracks there, that still had your old mud brick, two-story tile-roofed old buildings with, courtyard houses and so on. Now, really, the only place you can see that in Kunming is in the old Burden Flower Market. It's the only place you can find those old buildings. Well, in the late 70s, they were still here. Even in 97, there were a few of them off there. In the area just behind where that mile-long stretch of computer shops is. The largest stretch of computer shops I've ever seen in any country in the world, and being a computer nut, I like to see that, but that wasn't here then. So the growth has been remarkable. And as the municipality now, the municipality has a population of 5 million. That is deceptive to some extent because, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I guess, just before we came for the WA thing, they had extended the boundaries of the municipality clear out to Stone Forest. Yunnan is one of the prosperous places in the country, at least municipal places and so on. So people come here from all over the rest of China because there's some way of making money here. Partly, of course, that's because of the almost unique position of Yunnan in the Chinese economy, namely that, I say almost, not quite, there are a couple of other instances. Yunnan's economic connections of importance are overland into Southeast Asia, more perhaps than with the rest of China. Well, you're presenting a paper on that in Hong Kong in later this year, Yuan, so you know a lot about that, which gives it a, how do I want to say this? Which makes Yunnan attractive really for two reasons. One, there are things that you can get into that can make you some money. But two, it's also interesting. And you have to remember something about China, something that I know that you're familiar with by now. It's a country in which the people in any one part of China are immensely curious about other parts of China. It's the greatest internal tourist system in the world, It really is. There are figures on that. Give a Chinese family a holiday, and what do? They go touring to remote other areas of China. And so people come here, and it's interesting, and it's different, and it's fascinating, and it's a source of prosperity. You can't lose. So a lot of Kunming has grown that way. I wish I had figures. I mean, I know they exist, I just don't know them. What the proportion is of the current population of Kunming that are not Yunnanese. It's high, but I don't know what the figures are. I know that people have those figures.
I wondered if I could just get you to give 3 pen portraits. Three individuals who encountered in your anthropological troubles, Edmund Leach, Rodney Needham, and Chris, my former supervisor, Christoph von Führer, in any order that you
in want. Any order that I wish. Leach first, because I knew him the longest, or he knew me the longest, I should say. As you'll see in a moment, that's the right way to put it. Now, he came out to Burma in what year? What year did he come out, 38 or 39? 38, yeah. I thought so, but I wasn't certain. What his... what his commission was, because he was presently, at that point, commissioned, as you know. He came out to do the Kachin stuff, and lo and behold, he ended up as an officer in the Kachin Rifles. And his brief as an officer was in part intelligence work. I've never really known what it was, and it was none of my damn business. But in some way, I remember this was in late 38 or early 39, he saw me, he was talking to one of my relatives and I was sitting in the background. You've heard this story before, but I'm putting it in there. And of course, as everybody knows, Leach had total recall and a photographic memory. Having lost all his field notes during the war from a horse or mule that fell down 2,000 feet into a gorge, everything he wrote was from memory and was accurate. Well, anyhow, that's relevant as background to what I'm going to tell you. So we'd seen me briefly. I don't know if we ever had talked at that point. I was all of 15 years old and of no consequence, but I was there. Years later, I at the end of the Chin thing in 68, I went, before getting back to the States, we went to England, your place, and I went up to Oxford to see Rodney Needham. I'll talk about him subsequently. And was there for, I don't know, I guess it was one day only, wasn't it, that we were there?
I'm not sure that you meant 68, you might have meant 58.
58, I'm sorry, you're quite correct, 58, yes. So I go up to see Rodney at Oxford, at the Institute of Social Anthropology, as was. And he said, but you know, you really, given the work you've done on the alliance and marriage system and kinship and all of that, you really must see Leach. And I said, for reasons that I did not explain to him, that I thought I would feel perhaps very uncomfortable given the previous marginal contact with the man, but he said, well, he wouldn't remember anyhow after all of these years. And anyhow, I'm sitting there in his room and he telephones Leach and made the appointment. So of course I go back to London and then the next day by train up to Cambridge. Someday, do they have a train yet between Oxford and still not?
They used to once.
Well, I know they did at one time, but at any rate, I've never been able to make use of one. So I go up to Cambridge the next morning by an early train, and get to the museum and go down the hall. Jack Goody over here, Rio Fortune over here, I forget who was there. And Leach's room was at the far end, if you remember. And I walk in and his back is to me. He's on the blower, I think. He's on the phone and looking out the window there at whatever. And he hangs up the phone, turns around and looks at me and says, well, you know, you don't look that different from what you did when I... I mean, you know, you have to figure to do the arithmetic. That's from 38 until 58. And that's 20 years no matter how you do the arithmetic. And not only that, but who the deuce was I at the first time anyhow? I was a 15-year-old kid sitting on the side in the same room while he was there. I think maybe in two or three occasions like that. It was incredible. I said, but how can you remember that? And then Edmund proceeded to describe the room, the situation, where it was, who was there, what I was wearing. I have literally never encountered anyone in my life with such total recall. Quite astonishing. Well, you know Leach much better, or you knew Leach, I should say, much better than I, and you know that he could be a very difficult man. His family knew that he could be a difficult man. Everyone did. The reason Leach and I got on fairly well over the years until he died was that I didn't take offense at his published and unpublished attacks, because I gave back as good as I got. And I'll give you two examples of this, and they will, I think, resonate with your knowledge and what you call it, impression. So one thing, when I first published the Chin book, I cited a particular old source, and I cited it by the author's name. Leach did a review in Man and took occasion. I mean, he had to say good things about the book, I suppose, because perhaps it was good, or he thought so. But he had to attack something, and he says, look, Man's not really a scholar because he cites this author. Now, I know this book well. We have it in the library at Cambridge, and on the title page it says, by an officer in Her Majesty's service. I wrote back a letter to the editor in response to the review, or rather really only in response to that one attack, and I said, well, I'm sure that the copy in Cambridge Library says that, and so does the title page on mine, but I happen to have acquired the author's own copy, and he has his name signed on the title page. And I said, so and this was the kind of thing we did. Then years later, I believe it was 71 or 72, there was a big Orientalist Congress at Tokyo in Japan, and he gave a paper there that I slammed into in 74 at the International Congress of Anthropological Sciences, then was held in Chicago, and he was in the chair at the panel, and I took the paper apart, because his knowledge of Kachin was good, but he thought he was a linguist, and he wasn't, and he made such dreadful errors. And I took it apart, and Leach was somewhat annoyed, very annoyed actually at the time, but he did say, you know, I'm sure you were correct in the facts and in the analysis, and I had been wrong, but you know, there was no excuse for your having attacked me like that over it. I said, well, I did only what you would have done in the same circumstances, and we let it lie there at any rate. But he was strange man, and I suppose he did that with everybody. But we got on because I didn't mind. I'm quite as capable of doing it as he.
Can you just, as we had to move on, if you could just tell that story you told about his views about Kachin studying...
Oh, yes, all right. I realized that you wanted me to say that. I had a doctoral student, a PhD student, who was himself Kachin, and as a matter of fact was by succession, he was himself a Kachin chief, Dua. He had Oh, yes, right. He had his undergraduate degree was in mathematical economics. He switched to anthropology and linguistics. In other words, he was a well-educated, technically very well-trained person, a fellow named Moran Leroy, a good Jingpo name, from Burma. And given this kind of background and given his own knowledge as a hereditary chief of Kachin and so on, he wrote some stuff, published some stuff on that, took issue with some of what Leach said. In this case, it had to do with some cosmological notions and so on. And Leach wrote a letter to me in which, I forget what the letter as a whole was about, but in which he said, among other things, that he found it very peculiar and unacceptable that the Kachins were very nice people, he liked them very well, but really, you know, when it came to the intellectual analysis of systems of thought and so on, really, it's the, now whether he used this expression or not, I disremember, I must have the letter in my files, but the implications were altogether clear that when it came to the analysis of religious and cosmological, you know, system, philosophy, only the Christians could really have the background to do that. And he meant it. He was not being funny, I assure you. He was somewhat offended at Leroy. And years later, I was in the field, but he came to Illinois, Leach, I mean. Leroy hadn't taken his doctorate yet. I forget where I was. I was abroad at the time. And I think that's when he was offended. It wasn't, I know. It wasn't anything Leroy had written. It was Leroy getting into a discussion of these things in a public seminar with Leach, and then afterwards Leach wrote to me that he found this really quite unacceptable. I mean, man is Kachin, he's not one of us. We analyze these things. He said, you know, I like these people very well, but really. I think you had some similar encounters with him. He was that way. He was. I'm using a word you used at dinner table a couple of weeks ago. He was a dreadful snob. And I think he was very pleased to get his knighthood, even though it had nothing whatsoever to do with his work. Well, he only got it because he was Prince Charles's tutor, you know. He didn't like people to say that, by the way. But it was true nonetheless. All right, Edmund. You asked me at one point a couple of weeks ago, you said, you wondered if I had wondered how Leach managed to do ethnography because he didn't get on with people very well. I think he got on with them much better if he felt they were in their proper place. And I didn't say that to you the other day because I didn't think how to put it, but I believe that that's the case. I think with people who were in their place and clearly subordinate, he could get along with them much better, and I think that's why he did good work. Whom should I pass along to now? Rodney. Did you know Rodney at all? Rodney Needham. God knows what's happened to Rodney. No one ever hears of him anymore. Well, when Claudia left and he remarried somebody in the literary game or something like that, and he retired at the same time and disappeared into another existence. Anyhow, I first met Rodney in the late summer of 1956 at the International Congress of Anthropological and Ethnological Sciences held that year in Philadelphia. I was introduced to Rodney somewhat indirectly. My professor
Don't touch.
No, I did that accident. My professor, Heine Gelden, had introduced me to your supervisor, Heimendorf, and Heimendorf introduced me to Rodney, and I was telling them about the things I was planning to do. I went off the next year, well, half a year later, into the Chin Hill. So we were talking about all of those things and so on. And that's how I came to stay in correspondence with Rodney. And during my time in the field, and went up to Oxford. He asked me to, on the way back, to go to Oxford to, you know, to see him and so on, which I've told you about. Rodney, Rodney was a strange man, as you know. I'm just trying to think. He was obsessed with being an Oxford man. That's the only way I can say it. I will tell you a story. I don't think I told it you last time I spoke with you. Maybe I did. I had been visiting him. This was at another occasion some years later, and I'd been visiting him in his rooms, actually at his house there in at Oxford, and then I had to go and see the late G.E. Harvey, if you know who he was, Burma historian and so on. He lived over in St. Margaret's. 37 St. Margaret's Road, I don't know how I remember that. So I had to get there, and Rodney had to put me on a bus. And I'm going up, it was one of the two-decked ones that they still had. I don't know if they have any of those in Oxford anymore. They do still, but anyhow it was. So he says to the driver that he has to yell out and tell me when we get St. Margaret's Road, because I don't know the place. And gratuitously, he says, and he's speaking very loud, the man's an American, he's a professor. But then, you know, he said, anybody in America can be a professor. And he wasn't being funny either. He meant it. He was that kind of a person. And nothing was more important to Rodney than to be seen as a famous Oxonian scholar. And to have the reputation of simply being ever so much better than anyone. I don't know how he felt about people at Cambridge, but about any place else, officially he looked down on them. And years later, he was in the States, and again there was National Conference, Anthropological Association Conference, and I had known Rodney by then for a number of years. We'd corresponded, he'd cite me in things he did, so it wasn't that he didn't remember me, but I said, how do you do to him, you know, hello, in the hall, and he just cut me dead. He didn't know who I was suddenly, because the people he was with, he shouldn't know somebody like, you know, it's that, or he thought this. There was at the same conference at the same time a colleague of mine, a then now retired colleague, a man named Clark Cunningham, who was Rodney's first PhD student, who had been, I should say. In fact, I'd first met Cunningham in 58 when I first see Rodney. Cunningham was just going out to Sumatra at that time, no, to Timor. Sorry. And he cut Cunningham dead too. Same thing. Junior people were he. See, by then Rodney had the chair at Oxford. And that set him far above ordinary people, particularly Americans, since, of course, as you see, anyone in America can be a professor. It's not true, incidentally. You may not realize that, but it really isn't true. And in any event, he cut Clark Cunningham dead. Clark Cunningham, who was his first PhD pupil, and Cunningham and I had a discussion of this back in Illinois, you know, a month later, 2 weeks later, whatever it was. And we were talking about it, and I said to Clark, I said, well, you know, Rodney, after all, his position, I said, you know, Rodney is after, and Clark interrupted me. He said, yes, he's a revolving son of a bitch. And he really was, but a brilliant man who never really did any real field work in his life. A brief sojourn among the Penan in Sarawak, and he passed through Malaya briefly a few years later and did about a week's work with, well, I forget who he was with, a chap named Downs, a former friend of his at Oxford. And that was it. But all his theoretical work was brilliant and yet flawed in a particular way. I give you two examples to show you, and this is a matter of public record, so you don't have to take my word on it. Rodney, as you know, was the organizer of two translations from the French of important années sociologique types. First was a, which was it, of Durkheim and Mauss's, I forget which it was, one of,
primitive classification.
Yes, primitive classification, thank you. And the second was, well, no, Hertz, no, he used a lot of Hertz, but that hadn't, no, it was primitive classification, and then, of course, he organized the translation of Structures élémentaires de la parenté. Now, notice that in both of them, the introductions, the translator's introductions are fascinating, because he translates these works, but in the introduction, because presumably they're of importance, and in both of these introductions, he slams them for being entirely wrong and absurd. You remember that? He does it in both those cases. It's not actually, you know, he might have done it once, but to do it twice in a row like that, I mean, he was being Rodney, that's all. Strange man. Well, he got his when the graduate student, the postgraduate students at the Institute threw him out, voted him out. Do you know that he was literally not allowed to come through the door without permission? It was. He was not literally not allowed to enter the premises without an invitation. So he ended up hanging out at his favorite place, which was his rooms at Merton.
All Souls.
All Souls, was it? Well, he had he was originally Merton, that's right, which he had been very proud. Then he was at All Souls, okay. But at any rate, so much for Rodney. Still, his contribution to all of these issues about alliance theory and so on were very important. He ended up being wrong more often than he was right, but that doesn't matter, because his contribution to the discussions and their progress was considerable and, I feel, enduring. Likewise, again, a book in which he was wrong, but it led somewhere, and that was the book on belief, language, and experience. Those two certainly were of great importance, all of those things. I've said some bad things about Rodney here, but that doesn't mean I don't respect his work. I do. And I think it is a great shame that apparently he's being forgotten so quickly. I think that's too bad, because it was very useful work.
And finally, just very briefly on...
All right. I met Heimendorf, as I said, in 56 at Philadelphia at the International Congress, introduced by the other famous hereditary aristocrat of Austria in anthropology, and that was my professor, Heine Kellner. And I have rarely met a nicer man. Now, I've said some bad things about Leach and about Needham, two people whom I respect greatly. I think Leach somewhat more. But Heimendorff deserves a great deal of respect and praise, not only because he was such a delightful person, nobody knows that better than you, but because he was a man who all his life continued to grow intellectually. I mean, look, here's a man comes out of the old Kulturkreis school out of Vienna, becomes an anthropologist, works in India and Nepal and so on. He ends up in the anthropological chair at SOAS and so on. And you know, a lot of, well, you do know, again, nobody knows better than you, Alan, a lot of his latter day work, let's take the Merit and Morals book, which I've recently written an article about in a book that's just come out. That was a piece of perfectly excellent modern social anthropology. He didn't dig in his heels and say, I'm still an old-fashioned cultural historical anthropologist. He gave that up. He learned from the new places he was in the new work. He did very, I mean, he continued to grow intellectually, as I said, and one of the kindest men I've ever met. You know, I'd show up in London and, oh, well, even now you're here, good, will you attend my seminar? It might be, let me introduce you to, always this way. You remember, he'd always slick his hair back. I forget if it was the left or the right hand, I disremember. And it was always one, I just don't, no, it was the left hand. It was the left hand. And, you know, I mean, apparently sincerely pleased to see someone and, you know, well, what can I do? Let me introduce you to this person. Oh, I really want to talk about, incredible. And incredibly productive when you consider all the places he did fieldwork, and in each of those places making a series of major contributions to the ethnography, not only descriptive but analytical. You can't beat it. You really can't.
In my view, I think I've made a fair survey of the 20th century. I think he is the greatest ethnographer of the 20th century.
I think he is. I certainly for Asia and so on, that has to be. No, I think without any qualification, I think he was, because he never did a bad piece of ethnographic work. He never did a slipshod or sloppy piece of ethnographic work.
Even when friends of mine have been to follow him up, he's been to a place for a week, done a description of that place. They say, other people would have taken a year to do what he did.
He was amazing.
He knew what to look for, very observant, photographic memory.
Did he also know that? I did not know until just now.
Yes, photographic memory. And wonderful note taker.
Well, yes, that I knew.
And of course, the greatest 20th century filmmaker, ethnographic filmmaker as well.
Which I have only learned in this past month, you know, listening to you. I never knew that about him until now.
And one of the two or three greatest ethnographic photographers of the 20th century.
Yeah.
His photographs are stunning. So, and as you say, a kind man. So it was
he was really one of the, not only kind, but kind in an old-fashioned, cultivated way, which was so very pleasant.
Yes, exactly.
Always.
Which could also be said of you. So,
no.
I would like to thank you very much indeed.
You are more than welcome. It's been a pleasure, not so much saying this, you know, because I don't care one way or the other whether I'm asked to talk or not, but it's been a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you.